Welcome. This is Cascade Church Portland's podcast. We exist to invite all people to join us as we follow Jesus together in bringing heaven to earth. So as Sarah said, my name is Kurt, pastor here. And going back to why we started and why we're here, there's a lot of ways that in our culture and our world, when it comes to talking about faith and spirituality and God, we have conversations that are less than the most important thing. Like the secondary and the tertiary, like keep on getting down the list of things that involve faith and God and spirituality become primary. They become really, really important. And that's something that breaks my heart. I think there's a lot of people in our world that have a desire to explore a relationship with God. Like, what does that look like? Who is God? And we want to facilitate conversations that say there's a lot of things that are secondary. They're not a part of knowing God. And if we can talk about those issues and we can say, it's okay to disagree. It's okay to fall on other sides of the line. And we can still like discover who this God is together. That feels like something that's bigger and better and more beautiful. And so we wanted to have that conversation. We thought, well, we have a friend. We met him 4 years ago at an awesome event, and he does this well. He does this better than anyone we know. He hosts an amazing podcast called Ask Science Mike. He's the co-host of a podcast that just put out their last podcast. It's like the most life-changing conversation on race that I've heard recently. He co-hosts The Liturgist with Michael Gunger, and he has a book releasing September 13th that is going to be amazing. Would you welcome Science Mike McCart?
Bing. Well, good morning. How are you? Did you sleep well? Thank you for being here on a Sunday morning. I had a time in my life where I stopped going to church and did brunch instead, and the transition back was tough. Like every Sunday, I'm like, you know, maybe the Eucharist this Sunday could be waffles and coffee. It's just a thing. So, thanks for having me at your church. I was thinking, I was sitting here, like, it has been many, many weeks since I've been in a church on a Sunday morning. Last Sunday, I was on a tour bus, which is very, very unchurchy. And because of the work I do, I love the church and I never get to go. I'm actually like almost overwhelmingly excited I will actually go to my church next week. So that's an unbelievable thing. Anyway, as mentioned, I'm Science Mike. I want to be really clear about something. I didn't name myself Science Mike. I actually fought that moniker because like it's just kind of pretentious to like name yourself after a discipline of human study. Like, you're an authority. What actually happened, imagine you really like soccer, and your name is Bob. And, like, all your friends know you love soccer, and so at parties, they like to ask you questions about soccer. And then someone called you Soccer Bob. And then a couple of your friends who write books said that publicly, and then your name disappeared. That's what happened to me. As mentioned, I host these two podcasts. This is the sales portion of your sermon. I included the pictures if you want to find them on iTunes. And then this is my book that comes out September 13th. And my publisher will hit me with a wet noodle if I don't mention this every time I talk. So September 13th, Finding God in the Ways. What we're actually going to talk about today is a book that sold better than mine. And that's the Bible. And I don't know where you're at with the Bible this morning. I don't entirely know where I'm at with the Bible this morning. But I can tell you where I used to be with the Bible. Where I used to be with the Bible was that this book was written by God. Because I grew up Southern Baptist. And Southern Baptists call themselves people of the book. With the implicit assumption that other people aren't. I don't know if you caught that. We're the people of the book. Those Methodists and Catholics were not so sure. And what Baptists believe about the Bible is that it's infallible and inerrant. And so if the Bible is infallible and inerrant, then basically, you know, dudes in the desert, you can just picture them with their quill, which is anachronistic. There weren't quills, but I just like the image. And they're writing on parchment, and God is just like whispering in their ear, like every word they're supposed to write down. And that's how I understood the Bible. And it was awesome. It was like an amazing way to read the Bible for 30 years of my life, because that view of Scripture gave me an overwhelming confidence that I understood what God wanted from me. And so I was able to structure my life so that I gave God the goods, right? And what was the payoff of giving God the goods? Like a good life yourself. Now, I don't mean in like a prosperity gospel way. I mean, I had a good marriage. I was a good employee, so I was successful. And things were a lot of fun. But then I met Carl Sagan. I didn't actually meet Carl Sagan, but I read his books. And I saw this image. And this is the pale blue dot. I don't know if you've seen it before. It's amazing. Because right here, see that little blue dot? That's the Earth. So this was taken from the Voyager spacecraft in 1977. And Voyager in those days was traveling about 40,000 miles per hour. And it was just past the orbit of Saturn. And Carl Sagan convinced all the other nerds at NASA to have Voyager turn around and take a picture of the Earth. And the scientists were like, hey, Carl, that's dumb. We have lots of pictures of the Earth that are way better quality and give us a lot more data. And he said, no, you guys, trust me. This is important. So because Carl Sagan was Carl Sagan, they end up taking this picture. It's like the most distant selfie ever. And what's amazing about it is it reveals a very unique perspective on us, because that's the entire human story. That's, as Carl Sagan said, every war we've ever fought, you know, every couple in love, everything that's unfolded in our history happened there. And it shows that everything we get upset about, the things we fight about, is for a tiny portion of a fraction of a pixel, or as he said, a mote of dust suspended in a sunbeam. It's really wild. Now, here's the thing about that picture. Because it was taken outside of the orbit of Saturn, at light speed, it took a really long time for the image to get back to Earth, because the sky is a DeLorean. It's a time machine if you're not old enough to know Back to the Future. If you're not old enough Back to the Future, I call you to repentance. You can get the trilogy on iTunes this afternoon and get right. But the sky is a time machine. This is just kind of trippy, and it does relate to the topic this morning. This is the moon. I don't know if you've seen the moon. It's pretty cool. I like to look at the moon in a telescope because it's so close. Like, the moon looks like it's really textured. There's a lot of stuff going on there. But if you go outside tonight and the moon is going to be gibbous, almost full, so it'll be a really good night to look at the moon, you're looking at the moon 1.3 seconds in the past, because light only goes 186,000 miles per second. Only 186,000 miles per second. It tells you the moon's a little more than 186,000 miles away. So if aliens came and landed right here and put up a billboard that said, "Hello, humans," we wouldn't know for a second. Obvious, right? You with me? This is the sun. Don't go stare at it. It will damage your retina. But when you go out and you're going to be very aware of the sun no matter where you're on the earth. Those photons that warm up your cheek left the sun 8 minutes ago. So if the sun disappeared, we'd have 8 minutes of blissful, warm ignorance, right? Which is amazing, especially because the sun is very massive. That's why it has nuclear fusion happening in its core. And its gravity well is so deep that when photons are created in the center of the sun, they spiral around it in an ever-increasing orbit. It takes 100,000 years for photons to get from the center of the sun to the surface. Once they get there, it only takes them 8 minutes to get to the Earth. So when photons hit your cheek, they're 100,000 8 minutes old, which is just cool. This is Saturn, the crown jewel of the solar system. Have you ever seen Saturn in a telescope? Raise your hand. Oh, you are a deprived and poor people, and I weep for you. Rectify that as soon as possible. You have an observatory, maybe, in town? Like, when you show people Saturn in a telescope, they go. And then about a half of them will walk to the front of the telescope and look for a sticker, because they can't believe, like, that yellow dot turns into that. It's an hour in the past when we look at Saturn. I'm sorry, like, that still freaks me out. Imagine the alien things. Aliens show up, they start harvesting the rings. They steal the rings of Saturn. By the time we call the cops, they've been gone for an hour. Neptune, 4 hours in the past. Pluto, sorry, dude, not a planet anymore, but 7 hours in the past. And by the way, Pluto, the planet we found with New Horizons, has a picture of Pluto, the Disney animal, on it. Checkmate atheists. This is Proxima Centauri. That's the star closest to ours. 4 years in the past. Orion's belt, the three bright ones there. This is a Hubble image, so it shows a lot of stars. They're between 800 and 1,000 years in the past. Think about what's happening on Earth 800 to 1,000 years ago. This will relate to the Bible in a minute. This is Andromeda, the galaxy closest to the Milky Way. This is like Seattle, galactically. 2.5 million years into the past. So when you look at Andromeda, you can kind of see on a really, really dark night, not in Portland, but maybe somewhere further out, Andromeda with a naked eye. But with a telescope, you can see it. It looks like a milky patch on most telescopes. And she's got a really big one. Those photons have been traveling through space 2.5 million years. This is the Hubble Deep Field. These are galaxies. So now this is a patch of sky smaller than your pinky nail that Hubble looked at. And these are not stars, these are galaxies. Each one of those dots has over 100 billion stars in them. And they're so far away that they don't exist anymore. They're ghosts. All those stars exploded a long time ago. And if you keep looking out, you see this. This is the cosmic microwave background radiation. This is an image of the universe the moment it became translucent to light. Now, because space is expanding, it's not visible light anymore. It's microwaves now. But we took a picture with this. This is the WMAP satellite. And it goes up and it scans this 360-degree panorama of the cosmos. And we get a baby picture of the universe. I mean, if that doesn't trip you out a little bit, you need another cup of coffee. Like, a picture of the universe just 380,000 years after it was created. So what does that have to do with the Bible? Well, as a young evangelical, I was astounded how well the Bible told this story. Because the earth was without form and void, and the darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. Seminary folks in the house will know that waters here is endemic of chaos. And the universe was dark at first. It was so hot in the singularity, light couldn't exist. Right? Photons got annihilated as soon as they were formed. So that's a pretty good poetic description of an initial singularity that started the Big Bang. Written by dudes in the desert 3,500 years ago. That's amazing. And then I hear this, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord is one." And I think about how in a singularity, time and space and matter and energy and the four fundamental forces of physics were all this unified mystery. Man, go Torah authors. You guys killed it. And then God said, let there be light, and there was light, and you had a rapid expansion of this singularity. And 380,000 years later, the universe was transparent to light. Light could exist. It was the first, most fundamental property of the universe. But more important than that, light itself, lights, you know, have you heard E equals MC squared? That C is the speed of light. It is literally the only universal reference frame that holds the universe together. And so these guys are saying light is the foundation of creation, and so does physics. God saw the light, and it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness. It took 380,000 years. That's exactly how it happened. And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night, and the evening and the morning were the first day. And God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters. And God made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament, and it was so. They keep saying firmament a lot. And God called the firmament heaven. In the evening and the morning were the second day. Now, I'd read this passage like a gazillion times growing up. And I'd always saw the word firmament, and assumed it meant terra firma, right? And then I was reading the Bible rather critically because my parents' marriage was falling apart, and I was looking for answers. And I noticed it said, and God called the firmament heaven. I was like, no, God called the firmament earth. This must be one of those hippie translations. So I went back to my King James, and even the old King James called the firmament heaven. So I went and I did what I've learned to do since I like to consider myself a Bible geek. I like to look up things in the original language because I'm totally qualified to do that, not speaking Greek or Hebrew. But I've got Google. And Google told me firmament was rakia, this Hebrew word. And I was like, okay, yeah, I definitely don't know that word. So then I Googled this word, right? Instead of firmament, I Googled rakia. And am I saying it right, seminary folks? Rakia, is that close? Not even close? Nobody knows? Okay. I'm sure someone on the internet will tell me. And I got this image when I Googled rakia. Okay. And according to this image, this was the biblical worldview for most of the Old Testament, wherein the earth was a disc or a square, hence having corners, and it was on columns of the earth that held it up. And there was Sheol below the earth. That's where the Hebrew people thought you went when you died, before you slowly faded away to nothing. And there's this firmament, these interlocking plates. And they've got holes in them. And so the light of heaven can shine through those holes, or the floodgates of heaven can be opened, as happened with Noah, and rain can fall and flood the earth and later just replenish the earth. And they have the oceans over here, which are coming from these floodgates that dump over the firmament into the oceans that surround everything. That's a little different than this, which is the view of creation I just talked about, where you had quantum fluctuations that led to a rapid inflation of a singularity, an afterglow pattern. There's that baby picture of the universe. A dark universe where light was possible, but there weren't any stars yet. So it took a while for hydrogen, helium to clump together and create the first stars, created galaxies. After those first stars had their life cycle and exploded, you had heavy elements and planets. And then eventually, somewhere around here, you get an Earth. And somewhere around, that pixel, you get human life. Right? These are different. No matter what you think, I hope you can agree with me that those two are different, right? If anyone thinks those two are the same, see me afterwards. I would be fascinated with your reasoning. This was a huge problem for me, a young evangelical who believes in inerrancy and infallibility. I was told when the Bible speaks to science, the Bible's always right. And it led me to wonder, how can the Bible and the night sky tell different stories when both were created by God? how is this possible? Now, if you're astute and especially faithful, you may be asking yourself a question right now. Who cares? I don't know if you know this, we have actual problems in the world. Here's the thing. What I'm about to talk to next is a huge deal. Because Genesis describes a garden where life was placed in it. This is the biblical view of how life came to be. Darwin described this. In America, those two models are pretty evenly split in the population. In the rest of the world, not so much. Darwin is taking over quite successfully. And this is a problem for the church. This is a huge problem for the church, even in Portland. Because the best way statistically to predict that someone will leave Christianity is they accept Darwinian evolution and their church does not. It's not same-sex marriage. It's not drug legalization. It's not any other hot point issue. It's not abortion, right to life, whatever you want to name. None of those predict as well a difference in acceptance or denial of Darwinian evolution. So, what if we learn to have better conversations on this? And this will all come back to the Bible in a minute. First of all, everyone believes evolution happens. Every single person in it, Ken Ham from Answers in Genesis, believes in evolution. Evolution is change, right? You evolved this morning because you didn't show up in pajamas or whatever you wore. Evolution doesn't say anything about how life appeared on the earth. That's a biogenesis, which is unsolved in science. And evolution does not say that human came from monkeys. And for some of you, you're going, oh gosh, this is such a review. But based on my work, even in Portland, people throw that line around, right? We came from donkeys. No. Evolution says human and monkeys came from a common ancestor that wasn't a human or a monkey. And of course, evolution is not just a theory. Evolution has so much evidence behind it that scientists say it's a safe assumption for future work. It's not a theory the way we use the popular word theory. And the only reason I care and the only reason I talk about this in churches all the time is because it's a canary in the coal mine. So if we ask people to choose between Jesus and evolution, it seems as if statistically they choose evolution. Why? The fossil record. They look at lots of physical evidence, and if they get badgered over the head of, you have to take this view of creation to get the gospel, then they go, I guess I can't get the gospel. And they go, peace, I'm out. And we're reaping that whirlwind all over the country. This is the engine that's leading to spiritual, not religious. This is the engine that's leading to no religious affiliation. And it's dumb. This is the dumbest hill to die on for the church. I mean, honestly, who cares? Now, we're in Portland. You guys don't care. I'm sure like the vast majority of people are like, evolution, fine, right? But all over the country, and here's the other thing. In Portland, Seattle, Los Angeles, I've noticed this thing. To be a Christian, you have to be super countercultural. Because you have these post-Christian societies, which means the biggest churches, the loudest voices of Christianity in Portland tend to be very fundamentalist on creation, which means part of the gospel message you deliver is Jesus is okay with Darwin. Like, that's an important messaging point for the world. Can you believe that's where we are as a society? Man, starving people, and we got to talk about Darwin. But otherwise, we're losing a generation. So here's the thing. What I want to do is I care most about creating good conversation. So I actually respect people that have a six-day view of creation. And I do my best to fully understand and honor their insights, right? So what I'm trying to do is help other people do the same for the views of creation. So here's the thing. There are several positions on creation in the church. Young Earth creationism, six literal 24-hour days. Historically, this is a pretty new idea, but today it's the most conservative view, even though it's a newer one. A more traditional idea in the church is Old Earth creation, that Genesis represents six eras, that the word yom in Hebrew, translated day, can mean different time periods if you want to hold to a more literal view. There's evolutionary creationism, which is that Genesis contains tons of metaphor, but Adam and Eve were totally real people. There's theistic evolution, and that's that Genesis tells us about God's role in creation and character, but is not a factual account. And then there's naturalistic evolution. God had absolutely nothing to do with any of this. You're like, this is the most boring Sunday morning ever. But this is the most important slide. The canary in the coal mine. We tell people in the church, if they can't do these, their only option is here. So I'm on this crazy mission to get the church to admit these two are a thing. Like the whole church, not just Cascade Portland, where this is a super easy sell. There's a group called BioLogos that spends all their time espousing evolutionary creationism. Theistic evolution is actually really, 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 really phenomenally underrepresented in the church, but is a great God-centered alternative to naturalistic evolution. Okay, let's get less boring before I put you all to sleep on a Sunday morning. Augustine said, in the essentials unity, non-essentials liberty, and all things charity, I'm arguing that how the earth was created is in the non-essential slash liberty category. In fairness, my essentials category is probably way smaller than most people. That's kind of a hallmark of my work. But whenever I show this, I'm the size of this room, statistically, at least 3 to 5 people are thinking this right now. But if evolution is true, doesn't that make the Bible wrong? Which is a quote I attribute to everybody. I thought it was really clever. And then a quote from my good friend Pete Enns. It is important to remember that God always speaks in ways that people can understand. So let's for a moment grab a reference frame where we assume the Bible is inerrant and infallible. Okay? Imagine that God spoke to Moses and said, in the beginning, there was a nearly infinitely compressed space-time wherein the four fundamental forces of physics were unified and causality did not yet exist. However, quantum mechanics was still effective, not only at a micro level, but at a macro level because of space-time compression. And thankful to Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, this singularity began to expand, and as it did so in a way that had ripples that were correlated with quantum uncertainty. Thanks to the highly compressed ratio of gravitational attraction, gravity became a repulsive force and accelerated the fabric of space-time faster than light speed. Do you think Moses would understand that? Did you understand that? I said it, and I'm not entirely sure that I understand it. A cosmologically accurate view of creation to Moses would have been useless. And I think, when I read about superstring theory, when I read about quantum loop gravity, we don't understand creation yet. And we have like particle colliders and satellites. So, here's where I've come through this journey with the scriptures. Because I got to be honest, I went through a time in my life where I believed in God, but I couldn't read the Bible without it triggering some kind of post-traumatic stress disorder. That every time I picked up the Bible's pages and tried to read them, my skepticism caught fire, and I thought, I can't do this. I can't believe in God. I can't believe in Jesus. This is some kind of comforting myth. And this is after I had literally heard Jesus talk to me. If you haven't heard my story, I'm a little wacky. What do we do with this book? Well, we talk about Jesus, and Jesus is the center of my faith, which is why I'm a Christian. And we say that through an incarnation, Jesus is human and divine and fully both. And I think the Bible is too. That if we focus too much on the Bible's divinity, we lose its humanity. People are messed up. I don't know if you know any, but they're pretty messed up. So let's say, for example, after church, I grabbed four of you, and you all wrote down an account of this morning's worship service. And you didn't talk to each other. And then we read your four accounts. You would have given an honest portrayal of your experience in this room, and they wouldn't agree because you're human. So the Bible is not a constitution or a final word on anything. It's this thing we do in a modern society where we read the Bible like we read the Constitution, which is a really modern idea. There were no constitutions when the Bible was written. That wasn't a thing. I think a historically accurate view of the scripture is it records a debate about who God is and the stories of people of faith as they encounter the same God that we do today. This is, by the way, how rabbis read their scriptures, right? They don't look at this cohesive Old Testament narrative. They look at people fighting about who God is. And this one's huge. The author spoke to specific audience in specific times with specific agendas. It was a great thing in Levitical times to forbid people to eat pork and shellfish because they didn't know the temperature that food had to be held at to kill bacteria. And without modern sanitation, those are pretty deadly foods. Specific audience, specific agenda. It doesn't show some inconsistency on God's part. It shows a specific author talking in a specific time with a specific agenda. And when I go back to Genesis, remember I just kind of showed this beautiful alignment of cosmology and then a fracture. They went different directions. The beautiful thing about Genesis viewed this way with those three points is that it reflects an understanding of the world that was accurate in its day. The Hebrews believed in a firmament. So did the Babylonians. All contemporary cultures viewed the world that way. But God is the progressive point in Genesis, not the creation of the world. Because other creation stories of that era, which had a global flood, which often had a garden, in these stories, the universe was born from a fight between the gods, right? In one case, the belly of a god was split open and the guts became the stars, the blood, and the guts became the earth. Oh, this God speaks through thought and language and love. This God sees creation and says it is good, not a thing to be conquered or forgotten, which is a point, frankly, I still find profoundly comforting. This is a point that drives an idea like Martin Luther King saying the moral arc of the universe bends toward justice. Genesis speaks to God's nature in ways that contrast to other creation stories. This is a God who says things are good. And there's a final point in Genesis versus other ancient narratives that we usually miss. go forth, be fruitful, and multiply. Stars keep making new stars. Trees keep making new trees. The creation at the end of Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 does not stand complete. It is being created all the time, and we're invited to participate in that. That means we get to choose what kind of world we will make. Forgive me, this is the most stock photography of stock photography images I've ever selected, but I just like that guy sitting there looking at the sun over the clouds. Like, where do we find beauty? Is it a world that looks like this? Is it a world that looks like this? We have been given the freedom to choose that together. Right now, I think we choose to put a lot of carbon in the air. This pale blue dot viewed close, like, how do we treat each other? What kind of world are we making? You see, science reveals a God that is inevitable. I spent so many years as an atheist, and I thought it was good science. And it turns out that belief in God is an almost inevitable consequence of having one of these. Almost inevitable. You can Google Oxford Recipe for God and learn more about that if you're super nerdy. I won't waste your time this morning. But, you know, when I was a kid, I was told that we have a God-shaped hole in our heart, and that's ridiculous. The heart's a pump. If you had a hole in your heart, you would die. But you do have a God-shaped set of neurological biases, and that's totally true. And oddly enough, statistically, some of the people least likely to be atheists are the children of atheists. It has one of the highest family defection rates of any faith, even though I genuinely love atheists and atheism. And that when people grow up without faith, often they're the easiest to radicalize into fundamentalism. I think I'm safe to say this here. They say Christians support Donald Trump. But when you look at the data, the Christians that support Donald Trump don't actually go to church. There's an inverse correlation in church attendance and Donald Trump support. And the kinds of people who convert to Islam and commit acts of horrible terror are usually people raised in non-religious homes that convert to Islam and are radicalized. That this longing for God can be exploited and is exploited all the time, which means we have a responsibility as Christians to espouse a God that's beautiful, a God that encourages peace. Jesus didn't come into my heart. He came into my anterior cingulate cortex, which is the part of the brain responsible for love, compassion, and empathy. And when you teach a God of love versus a God of anger, you change people's brains. Did you know that? You literally change human brains depending on how you describe God. If you teach people about a God whose primary attribute is anger or wrath or justice, you mess them up. Their amygdala, the part of the brain responsible for anger, gets more and more active. They have higher stress levels. It's more difficult for them to forgive themselves or to forgive other people. They become xenophobic or fearful of outsiders. They do get awesome impulse control, I will say that. Because if you think God will smite you, you know, it's easier to break bad habits for a while. But when you tell people about a God of love, which if Jesus doesn't embody a God of love, I don't know who does, the brain changes in different ways. Their prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain responsible for focus and empathy and concentration, gets thicker and richer and stronger. The anterior cingulate cortex, love, compassion, empathy, gets stronger. And this does something. It robs energy from the amygdala. Your brain only has a 20-watt budget. So if you're using all your energy to be thoughtful and compassionate, there's not enough calories and oxygen left over to be angry. That simple. It literally changes the way you see the world when you believe in a God of love. This is a good-looking guy. He's got a red beard. It's Vincent van Gogh. Very, very old selfie here. And what everybody knows about Vincent van Gogh is he cut off his ear because he was in love with a girl, which is factually true. But it would be like if all we knew about Steve Jobs was that he had a difficult relationship with the mother of his first daughter. Nobody talks about that with Jobs. They talk about Apple and Next and Pixar and all those amazing things. And what you may not know about Vincent van Gogh is he was a good Methodist like myself. And he had a heart for the gospel. And what he wanted more than anything was to be a minister. So he went to preacher school and he flunked out. So then he took a correspondence course and he flunked that too. It wasn't that he was lazy. It wasn't that he didn't try. He wept through this whole experience. He just wasn't very good at book learning. And so he appealed to a bishop who had pity on him and said, Vincent, you're probably never going to be a minister, but we can make you a missionary. We can send you to a village that doesn't have a church. You can plant a mission, and you can preach, and you can serve the Eucharist. You can do all the priest things without being an actual priest. Yeah, let's do that. So he goes to this village in Belgium, and it's a mining town. It's coal miners. And he gets there, and he's setting up his work, and he does something no minister should ever do if they want to be successful. He read the Gospels. And when he saw Jesus admonishing the rich young ruler to sell all his possessions, Vincent van Gogh went, yeah, that's a great idea. So he sold all his possessions, and he went down to the part of town where the coal miners lived, and gave away all his money. And he still had to sleep somewhere, so he went to the local baker, and he said, can I sleep in the haystack behind your baker shop? Yeah, well, man, whatever. So he would like climb in this haystack and sleep. And then he would show up on Sunday morning with hair like this, with hay on his clothes, smelling like bread, and start preaching. And his congregation was very embarrassed. So they raised a collection, and they had a church leader come to Vincent and say, okay, here's what we've done. We raised money for you. Go get a place to live. Get some new clothes, take a bath, and we'll see you next Sunday. So Vincent takes the money, and he goes down to the coal miners, and he gives it all away. Comes back to church. They take another collection. Vincent, clothes, home, shower, see you next week. You know what Vincent van Gogh did? He gave all that money to the coal miners. And he got fired from his mission. And he goes home. He writes his brother Theo of his grief. And Theo says, Vincent, you've always wanted to draw and paint. I will send you a little support money each week. And you just try that. And so in his grief over his failure in the church, Vincent van Gogh learns to be an artist. By the way, he sold one painting in his life. It's only after he died we figured out the genius he was. And Vincent van Gogh painted this, Starry Night. Now, I've seen it in person. Actually, one of the amazing things that's happened for me being Science Mike is I got to go look at this most influential piece of art in my life after hours and see it without crowds, and I just got to stand there and take it in. And it's like a sculpture. There's paint so thick. This is deeper into the canvas than the surrounding stars. This stands further out, like 3D. And I look at this painting, and I see the interplay of light and dark, of melancholy and beauty. I look at this painting and I see the world through the eyes of another person. Magically, I can see the world through the eyes of Vincent van Gogh, but it's only after I read his biography that I noticed in the center of the frame of the lit village at night, there is a church who is dark. The starry night is the grief of a man wounded by the bride of Christ. And let me ask you a question about this painting. Is the starry night infallible? Well, those words all make grammatic sense together, but they don't mean anything. But is the starry night true? It's the most true thing I've ever seen. And when I think about the Bible, I see the stories of people who, like me, long to serve God and try to figure out how. When I read the Bible, I see a library of books of people who just want to do right by the world and right by God. That is just as messy and confusing and beautiful and tragic as the starry night. Because is the Bible infallible is a ridiculous question. But is the Bible true? That's the guiding point of my life. Thank you.
You got me. Let's stand. Let's stand up. Here at Cascade, we come and we gather so we can go. We stand in a room full of starry nights. You guys have a story to tell. And God has worked powerfully. And so may we all go and share our story with the world. How God has worked and led you to this point and will lead you to many points farther because your story is true. Amen and amen. Have a great Sunday. We hope to see you next week.